RAAF is the second oldest air force and at the forefront of aviation for over a century. Be inspired by our remarkable air crew, maintenance personnel and support personnel who work tirelessly to keep our aircraft flying high and our skies secure. Host Gareth McRae, OAM, explores stories of humble men and women who, with daring and courage, established the Air Force as an Australian icon.
Let me introduce Henry Young, a former Naval Sea Fire and Sea Fury pilot. Henry served with both the fleet air arms of the British and Australian navies during the last days of World War II and after. He was born in Glenelg near Adelaide. His family relocated to New Zealand, where he enlisted for service as a 19-year-old in the fleet air arm of the Royal Navy as war broke out. After the war, Henry transferred to the Australian Navy Fleet Air Arm, and around that time, he met his late wife of 72 years, Madge. Henry says, and I quote, "I'm a fighter pilot. I'm competitive. I love the challenge of a tennis match. You can be down and make a comeback. Playing tennis on Rod Laver Arena to a cheering crowd of 15,000 is a dream held by every tennis player." For Henry Young, 99 years of age, the dream came true at a recent Australian Open. "It was just a glorious moment," he said. "This is the way to keep young, to be active, and keep some purpose in life." Henry Young has lived a full life. It is an absolute privilege and honour to have Henry Young on the phone and to undertake one of these amazing interviews. Henry, could I start by saying this is a real privilege for me to be able to talk to someone who has such a wonderful history with the Navy, with the Air Force, with the Army, with everywhere and all over the place.
I cost the taxpayer a lot of money.
Henry, the first thing I want to ask, my knowledge of World War II is what I read in books and what I see on documentaries. But you actually lived through it. What are some of your memories of the period of World War II between 1939 and 1945? Could you just share some of those memories with us?
Yes, by all means. My first memory, and it's always been there, I was still at school when the war started. And our head prefect, who was in the sixth form at the time, and the end of the year was September, so at the end of the year, and he was also the head of our cadets, of course, and he immediately joined up and came back to say goodbye to the school. And I can still remember how my heart went out to him and thought, would it all be over and I'll never get there?
Yeah.
But I did eventually make it.
Did you go to school in New Zealand or in Adelaide?
Actually, I was born in Glenelg in Adelaide, but my father was a banker and was transferred to New Zealand. This was when I was 10 years old, so that all my schooling virtually was in New Zealand at one of their prestigious private schools. Dunedin is the same as Adelaide. It was Wakefield's scheme, and the Scots, of course, put a great deal of emphasis on education, and they established this wonderful school, John McGlashan College. You know, I'm always grateful for the education I had through John McGlashan.
Sure. Were you around about 10 years of age when the war took place?
Oh, no. When the war started, I would have been, I suppose, 15 going on 16.
Right, so you were pretty close to needing to join up if necessary.
Yes, I knew that, you know, that. But when I really thought about it, I suppose I'd realised that I was in it.
Was it Dad's influence that made you join the Bank of New South Wales?
Well, my father was petrified that after the Second World War, it would be the same as it was after the First World War when unemployment was rife, and he said that, "Henry, we must get you a job that you can come back to." So that's what really got me into the Bank of New South Wales. I had actually 18 months in the Bank of New South Wales, which was quite long enough for me to establish that the one thing I didn't want to be when I came back was to be a banker.
What was the reason for joining in particular the Navy in New Zealand? What motivated that decision?
Well, I had been a Sea Scout, and I always loved the water, and I think that that's really the combination of being a Sea Scout and loving the water. That's what got me in.
Was there a time when you were in the Army as well? I got confused. You seemed to start in the Navy and then in the Army and then back to the Navy. How did that occur?
There was quite a rigorous assessment for New Zealand was the only empire country that supplied pilots to the Royal Navy. So it was a great compliment, really, to New Zealand. There was a lot of hoops you had to jump through, and I jumped through all of those well in advance. That got me into the Navy, onto the list. You did 3 months in New Zealand training, and then you went straight to England. I was a fortnight off going to, when I was still, I think it must have been about October, I think. Anyway, in October they attacked, and the Japs attacked, and I think September the 3rd, was it? It was a fortnight before I was called up for the Navy, and they panicked in New Zealand because the Army was in the Middle East, the Navy was in the Mediterranean, the Air Force was in England, and all they had back in New Zealand were the 18-year-olds, which was me.
Right.
So they said, everybody, report to the railway station with a bag on Monday, you're in the Army.
How long did you spend in the Army before then transferring back to the Navy?
I think it was about 6 months when the Royal Navy said, what happened to these beautiful young men you promised? And they said, well, they're all in the Army. It's an emergency out here. And they said, well, at least you could have put them in the Air Force. So they took me out of the Army and put me in the Air Force.
Yeah.
But at least we did a little bit of aircraft recognition and things like that until finally, took about 14 months, I suppose, with the Army and the Air Force before I finally got into the Navy. Army, Air Force and Navy, and I've flown in 4 of the world navies.
This is amazing. When they put you back in the Navy, I believe you went straight to England and you were on a cargo ship and you sailed via the Panama Canal. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And came up the coast in South America so that the Pacific was a pretty dangerous place to be at that stage.
And was that place that you ended up at the facility HMS St. Vincent?
Yes, HMS St. Vincent, which was the training establishment for the Fleet Era in Portsmouth. The 3 ways of doing anything, the right way, the wrong way, and the Navy way.
Henry, your time at HMS St. Vincent, was that a part of that training in aeroplanes, or was it specific training for Navy only?
Specific training for the Navy always says you're a seaman first and an airman second. They really ram this into you, and it's true that they made a sailor out of me in that 3 months. You know, coming from New Zealand, I'm a rugby man, and I was captain of the rugby team, so that really got me really established in the Navy because the Royal Navy loves rugby players.
Yeah, yes. Well, I love rugby players too. Just as an aside, I'll come back to your time in the Navy, but in your rugby team, I know that you got injured and that you had to have your nose fixed and they took part of your hip to make the new nose.
That was later on, but yes, I'm always getting my head into trouble, and that was big trouble.
Let's just stay with St. Vincent for the moment. Are you training, and they're doing naval training, that's understandable, but then come 1944, you end up going to the United States of America and St. Louis, and you had a voyage on Queen Mary. How did that come about?
The Queen Mary, of course, was a troop transport during the war, and because she was so fast, she didn't need an escort. And I went across as a first-class passenger to the United States. They'd put a division down the centre of the first-class cabin, and we had 12 on our side of the division.
That would have been an amazing trip.
The bunks were 4 high.
Who sent you to the United States of America? Was that part of the naval training?
Well, it was the Royal Navy. That worked out that when the two, or somebody had worked, actually Admiral Towers worked out that when the two navies got together in the Pacific, it would be a good idea to have some Royal Naval pilots that had trained in the United States so that we'd speak the same language when we got to the Pacific. And so I was one of those that was selected. And it was a selection process. Then again, I'm a rugby player.
that rugby seems to be a very important part of your life, Henry. So when did flight training begin in the United States? Because I know the Boeing Stearman was one of the planes that you were on.
Yes, the Boeing Stearman was the equivalent of the Tiger Moth that we had in the Air Force here, but it's more powerful and a beautiful plane to fly, but an ideal training plane. Yes, it was in St. Louis that I did my first training on the Boeing Stearman.
They, I believe, then sent you from St. Louis to Florida onto a Veni Valiant plane. Why was the move to Florida? What was the purpose behind that?
Well, they had it virtually in segmented. In other words, when you went from one plane up to a higher performance plane, you actually changed airfields. They called it the advanced training that we got in Pensacola, Florida.
Yep.
The Annapolis of the air, they called it. Annapolis was where all the seamen did their training.
Yeah. Tell me about the Valiant. What was that like to fly?
Very forgiving. Like the Tiger Moth, you just let it go and it flies itself. And so that it's an ideal training plane and powerful and a joy to fly, really. But I'm a 20-year-old and I'm in the United States as a 20-year-old. You can imagine what that's like.
You are very, very lucky and obviously very, very successful in your career because of your training. I know that you said once that at the Naval Air Training Base, you didn't want to be whittled out. What would have given you the impression that you may have been whittled out of the scheme?
Because being America, they anticipated there would be a big wastage of pilots in the Pacific. And so they anticipated this, and they got far too many in the training scheme to be pilots. You know, there wasn't the wastage they anticipated. And being United States, they said, we just carry on regardless. And out of every course that goes through, we want 50% or 60% of them will get the rest 50%, 60%. And the others just go back into the Navy somewhere. We all knew that, you know, we had this hangover hedge all the time that you only had to make a few blemishes and you were out. It's a hard scheme, but it's got to have the money to do it, of course.
Sure. Now, some couple of days after victory in Europe Day in May of 1945, I believe you started training in Corsairs. How did that come about?
That was, you know, just part of the routine. You, at some stage, they decided whether you're going to be a strike pilot or a fighter pilot, and everybody wants to be a fighter pilot, so that's what I aim for, and that's what they got. So that's how I came on to Corsairs, which was the final training stage.
Is this leading into deck training on an actual aircraft carrier?
The final step before you actually did your deck landing training. Once you were qualified with your Corsairs, you're a qualified fighter pilot, and you then go on to the next stage, which is learning to land on a carrier. And they couldn't do that to us in the United States, because just as we drive on the left-hand side of the road and they drive on the right-hand side of the road, somewhere it happened that batsmen signal that you are too low. In the Royal Navy, is two hands down in the lower position, and in the United States Navy, it means you are too low. It's an advisory thing, and the other one is a command, go lower. The one thing you don't do in the United States is do your deck landing training. So you go back to England to do that, and that's what they sent me back to England.
So it was because of the difference in US Navy signals that led you back to the United Kingdom. And was that trip back to the United Kingdom the intention to actually undertake more deck training in the United Kingdom?
Yes, that's right. In actual fact, they gave me another couple of courses while I was waiting instrument flying training, and I think another one with all but radar and all that type of things. A lot of additional training that the Royal Navy thought was important and the United States Navy didn't have the equivalent.
So in the United Kingdom, am I correct in assuming the two different planes are the Sea Fire and the Sea Fury?
Yes, the Sea Fire, the Sea Fury hadn't come through then. The Sea Fury only came through after the war as a replacement for the Sea Fire.
When you're doing your initial deck training, do they set up the equivalent of an aircraft carrier's deck on land and you start your training by coming into a phony or a simulated deck which is actually on the ground and not on a ship? Is that the way it works?
That's the way it works. Because it's tricky, because you, particularly with the Sea Fire, because it's so light and so powerful, when you cut your throttle, you don't immediately drop. In other words, there's a little gliding episode there, and you can't afford that. You know, in other words, you don't have the line, because in those days, it was before the angle flight deck. So the only way you could safely get there was actually to stall it, drop it onto the deck. In other words, have it just above the stalling point. When you pull your throttle, you stall and drop like a stone. That's what you've got to do, and the batsman tells you when to do that. And you're watching him like a hawk, of course. And as soon as he gives it, he cuts his throat signal, you pull your throttle off and down you go like a log. But because you're just above the stalling point, you can't see in front of you because you've got your nose right up. The only way you can actually do it safely is to do a turn to the carrier so that you're actually looking over your port shoulder and you can actually see the ship, and you only just straighten up, and that as you come over the rundown, you straighten up. So you can see the carrier the whole time, because as soon as you straighten up, you've lost it. But you haven't lost it. You've got your batsman out there on his little platform, cantilevered out over the side with a net underneath him.
If you actually drop the throttle, stall your engine, and to the point where you drop, is the engine still going, or have you literally turned the engine off?
Oh, no, you're still going. It's just that you've taken all the power off. If you happen to be sitting on the airfield at the time, it'd just be idling, like a car. Take your foot off the accelerator, it's still going.
If the Seafire is very similar to the Spitfire, it therefore has a very long nose and the wheels below the plane, so that you are almost coming in like at a right angle with the nose pointing up to the sky and you can't see the deck. That sounds like a very dangerous thing to be trying to do.
That's why they give you such a long training, because it is tricky. And, of course, you're getting all this training on land. It's not entirely different, but what you are doing is learning to trust the batsman implicitly. Whatever he says, he's an experienced, very experienced pilot, and he knows what to do, and he reads your mind as well as you're reading his mind.
So that partnership between you, the pilot, and that batman is almost as if you were both one person.
Yes, it is. It's a union of minds. It has to be.
Can you take us through your very first landing on a real aircraft carrier? Do you remember that?
Yes, it was on the Illustris in the Irish Channel, and it's a totally new experience. You're out in the mid-ocean, it's only just sea all around you, and the ship's going up and down. You're not used to this. You're putting your whole life in the batsman's hand, but you've been together then for so many weeks that you know each other, and you do what you're told, and by a miracle, you just suddenly find yourself on the deck. But also, it's exhilarating.
Yeah. You know? When you're coming into the aircraft carrier, is the communication between you and the batman only by signals, hand signals, or is there also radio communication as well?
It's only by signals, no communication over the wireless at all.
I know that while you were on board Illustris, and it was all part of the Lend-Lease deal where the United States of America didn't want its planes back, that you were actually pushing Corsairs over the side of the aircraft carrier into the sea. Is that true?
Yes, it was part of the deal under the Lend-Lease agreement that at the end of the war, they didn't want the Royal Navy flooded with planes. The agreement was that after the war, you either returned them or got rid of them. So when we were on the way back to New Zealand, and I was on the Illustris actually then that I came back to New Zealand on, and we picked up two squadrons of Corsairs on the, what was Ceylon then, Sri Lanka.
Yeah, Sri Lanka, yep.
And when we got out to sea, we pushed the two squadrons over the round down into the sea, all except one outer meter, which I unscrewed and which is in my office to this day.
Just be careful that the Americans don't want it back. How did you end up in 1948? You ended up in Australia and you started a Naval Fleet Air Army. You joined the Naval Fleet Air Arm. How did that happen?
But of course, I was in New Zealand, in the New Zealand Navy during the war, on loan to the Royal Navy and on loan to the United States Navy. Australia, after the war, decided it wanted a fleet air arm. The Royal Navy said it would take you 2 years to train up ex-Air Force pilots to Navy standard, so we will supply you the air crew for the first 2 years while you're doing this. I was then in New Zealand learning to be a farmer, and two of my friends who had flown with me during the war immediately alerted me and said, you know, we should go across. They would love us because we were fully trained. We could replace the United Kingdom pilots. And that's what we did. We came across, and I had to wait till the end of shearing, so I was a fortnight later when I came across. They were in a boarding house, and they came back from their day's work covered in grime. So I looked in the paper, and I saw an advertisement there for labours for Gilby's Gin Factory.
Gilby's Gin Factory.
When I went for our interview, they just looked at our logbooks, and then the great majority of the interview was, what was it like working in Gilby? Yeah.
So as part of the Australian season for you, were you part of the HMAS Sydney? Did you actually get to serve on Sydney as well or not?
Yes, we went to England. We first of all went to Yeovilton in the south of England, and then we went up to Lossiemouth for our deck landing training and refamiliarisation. And the Sydney was still undergoing trials at that stage.
Okay, right.
And then when it finally got ready, that's when we did, of course, our deck landing training. And then when the Sydney was ready, we flew on board and exercised with the Royal Navy and then came on out to Australia. And that's when we, in actual fact, on the way back to Australia on the Sydney, that's when we did our pushing of the
Corsairs overboard.
Of Corsairs, yeah. Into the water.
In Australia, was it? Did you have to do a conversion to the Sea Fury?
No, because when we went to England, that's when I did my initial deck landing on the Sea Fire. Then in Northern Ireland, I think we were the first, we might have been the second of the squadrons to be equipped with Sea Furies. Sea Fury was a wonderful plane to fly. It was, I think from memory, about 2,950 horsepower, and the Sea Fire was about 2,450. So it was a... In any dogfight with the Sea Fires, all you do is you put your nose up and give full throttle and...
Did you, in your career, in that period of time, Henry, did you have a dummy deck landing that you ended up crashing?
No, I had a particularly good run. I had an incident-free deck landing career. It's almost unheard of, but I didn't. I had my grapes ashore, but I never had a deck landing accident at all.
Oh, that's...
You know, I saw enough of them, but I was lucky.
See, all those few years earlier when you were frightened about being whittled out, there's no way that a person of your skill was ever going to be whittled out, Henry, really.
Once they spend a lot of money on you, then you are precious. They're very tolerant. They know that to get someone to replace you, it's going to take years and years and years of training to get them to that stage, which is why, you know, you can have quite a few crashes on a carrier and still fly.
Yeah.
And I was just lucky.
Something that I would like you to share with our friend who's listening to you right now. When you were part of the HMAS Sydney, you said takeoffs with no catapult was dangerous. What's involved in that? Why is it dangerous?
With the carrier, the strike aircraft and the fighters always go off first, and they've only got about then, you know, by the time you take off, where you rig, you've only got about a bit more than two-thirds, I suppose, of the carrier deck. It's an act of faith. In other words, you're sitting there, you're all warmed up, and they line you up, and then they flag you away, and you just give it full throttle. And there's no skill in taking off from a carrier. You just sit there and keep it straight. And either you fly or you don't. You put your life in the hands of your mechanics and everything else. Occasionally, it has happened to me, in actual fact, when I was one of those people right at range the first off, and they had me loaded up with camera equipment, which made me much heavier. And when I took off from over the rundown, and down I went. That's frightening, you know, because you've got your wheels down, and the first thing that hits the water are the wheels, which turns you over on your back. Then you've got to get, you're strapped in, you've got to get yourself out, and you've got to swim down and before you can come back up. They've got, particularly in the United States, well, they've got them in England too, what they call the Dilbert Dunkers. They have in the swimming pool, they have a cockpit strapped in on a railway line, and you're strapped into that, and you come charging down, you hit the water, and it goes upside down, and you've got to fight your way out down and come back out again. You do that about half a dozen times, and they have frogmen there to pull you out if you don't get out, and it's a frightening thing.
Henry, taking off or landing? Which is the more dangerous?
Oh, landing. Taking off is a piece of cake. Taking off is pleasant, particularly in the tropics, because you're sitting in your cockpit for probably 20 minutes at least in a hothouse. You have all these other planes warming up because you know you're going to go from idle to full throttle in a matter of two or three yards, so you don't want the thing to be spluttering. You have your cockpit closed because you can't stand the noise of the engine, and all the other engines around you all starting up until you're sweating so much that you can't, that you open it up to stop being cooked alive, and you can't wait to get in the air. You're in your element then.
Sure.
But sitting there in a glass house for 20 minutes is hell.
Henry, your last recorded flight was on the 24th of January in 1950 in a Sea Fury. Do you remember anything about that last flight in one of those planes?
Yes, I knew that it was going to be my last flight, and I loved flying. I didn't want my wife to be a Navy pilot, because to be a Navy pilot's wife is really, really hard. The men get all the glamour and all the stewards and the high life, and it's the wives who educate the children and look after them and wait for you to come home, and it's hard. That's why they're such wonderful people. But nevertheless, I didn't want it for my wife. So when I proposed, I said she could have me as an airline pilot or as a farmer, because I'd had 12 months on the land in New Zealand and I could learn to be a farmer properly. And so she said, I think I'd rather have you as a farmer because I'll see more of you. And so that's how I became a farmer and not an airline pilot, because I'd taken out Wendy Hudson Fish. The Navy's always in Hobart for the regatta, and Wendy was there, and I'd taken Wendy out, and I arranged with Wendy, could she arrange an interview with Qantas, because her father was Hudson Fish.
Hudson Fish. Wow.
One of the directors arranged an interview with you. You know that you've got a head start. And then they said yes, that they would love to have me, but they weren't taking on any pilots at that time. But they would put me on the list, and they could be, I could be assured that I would be accepted. And so that's when I said to Maggie, you know, she could have me as a pilot or as a farmer.
She chose farmer.
So I resigned my commission and became a farmer.
After service, Henry, I believe you spent something like 5.5 years in a bush hut with no electricity?
That's right. You know, as soon as I had to learn to become a farmer. So I went up to Gunnedah for 12 months on a wonderful property up there where just machinery was everything. And then I went to Scone for 12 months. And all the time I was putting in for soldier settler blocks. And for everyone I put in for, there'd be another 2,000 we put in for the same block. And then I heard of the AMP Land Development Scheme, who said that if you work for them for 5 years developing the 90-mile desert from scrub to pasture, they would guarantee you finance onto your own property with everything. Finance for your stocks, your sheds, your living allowance, the whole shooting box. And so that's how I got into the AMP Land Development Scheme.
You have had quite an amazing career. You start off in the Bank of New South Wales. You see yourself throughout World War II. You join the Army, you join the Navy, and you're still a pilot. You learn how to land and take off from an aircraft carrier. And then you spend 5.5 years after service in a bush hut with no electricity, and then you become a farmer. You must feel very blessed to know what a rich, varied career you've had and how you have contributed in such a meaningful and sincere way to New Zealand, to the United Kingdom, and now to Australia. You're a wonderful human being, Henry.
I'm very, very lucky. As you say, it's an extraordinary life. But the person I think who needs the most plaudits for it all is my good wife, Madge, who I lost about, I don't know, 2 months ago now.
Sorry to hear that.
And we had such a wonderful life together, 74 yeah. years of married life.
That wow.
We'd done everything. In other words, we'd in the Navy, while I was courting you, you know, we did all the nightclubs and all those beautiful things. And then we did this 5.5 years in the tin hut with no air conditioning, no electricity. And she took all of that, you know, from the life of luxury that she'd led. You know?
Yeah. Are you saying she got the booby prize?
You know, I mean, she's that type of person.
Yeah.
I just have been so blessed and so, so very blessed.
For me, this has been probably of all of the interviews that I've done for the Royal Australian Air Force, one of the most significant, given your contribution to the rich history of Air Force, Army, Navy and Australia. You are to be congratulated. you are an icon as far as I'm concerned, as far as Australia is concerned, and someone listening to you right now, all of the richness that you have shared with training on aircraft carriers and planes and your career, it's truly remarkable, and I want to thank you so much for allowing me to have a chat with you this morning.
I've enjoyed it. And, you know, as you say, I've been very, very lucky. Lucky Henry.
The motto of the Air Force is per adua ad astra, through adversity to the stars. Achieving the Air Force's mission is dangerous and sometimes deadly. Untold numbers of Air Force personnel perish and are damaged physically and mentally in war, peacekeeping, and civil emergencies. The Air Force Association's work is to provide these veteran aviators and their families with the necessary support services. If you can help with this vital work, please go to raafansw.org.au and look for the Help Us button.